But so what might happen was that I went to McGill, did a thesis, and got interested in cognition. But then I had to come back, because I had a scholarship instrument that I had to return here. And when I came back here, I started doing pigeon stuff. So a colleague called Ivan Beale and I did. We got sort of interested again in not in the corpus callosum, but in interhemispheric transfer. So we did some stuff with pigeons. Well, we actually glued little tubes on their eyes like that. And the thing about the pigeon, of course, is each eye goes to the opposite side of the brain, like in humans, where each eye goes to both sides. So this is a very good preparation to see what happens if you teach something to one eye and test the other. So then you're testing for what one hemisphere teaches the other. And we were greatly intrigued by some work that had come out of the US, Nancy, and she found that if you trained a particular discrimination, a left-right discrimination, it's reversed when it's tested in the other eye.
Did you replicate that?
We did. And the other thing is, pigeons are kind of normally a bit confused. If you teach them that and then show them that, they respond just as much to that,
yeah,
and less to the intermediate angles.
So this is a line on a bias.
A line on
it
a bias.
It switches to the line on the other bias.
And the idea is that one hemisphere transfers the mirror image to the other hemisphere.
Yeah.
So we did, I think, possibly the first, and I don't remember, the only split brain study in pigeon, and that sort of lends support to the idea that what each side of the brain teaches the other side, the mirror reverse. And that's why children, pigeons, cats are somewhat confused about left.
Yeah.
So that started the whole left-right thing, but not so much with respect to asymmetry, but with respect to symmetry. I mean, how the brain sort of symmetrizes itself. Bindra, I worked for, with him I really sort of was more into cognition than into the brain.
Okay.
I did try at one point. I thought I would try and do some stuff on what's called spreading depression.
Yeah.
So that you can kind of knock one hemisphere out by pouring in KCL, I think, and then testing what happens if then you let that side of the brain recover. I found I hated doing it. You know, those kind of little rats would be kind of knocked out. And so I never really got into that. I mean, some of my colleagues, of course, did John O'Keefe. I'll tell you a funny story about him.
Please.
The very first seminar we had at McGill as a graduate student was with Donald Hill. And I didn't know anybody in the class. There were a dozen of us, and we all sat there. And Hebb very peculiarly read out a letter from the University of Otago, and they were trying to recruit. And at the end of this, Hebb said, "You should never go to a place like that. You have decent research." And John O'Keefe was sitting next to me, turned to me and said, "My God," he said, "who'd want to ever go to New Zealand?" So I tried to explain that I'd just come from there, you know. And of course he went on and he won the Nobel Prize. And Bindra was very good. But he had very diverse interests. He had edited the Symposium on Motivation, the Russell Symposium. He allowed me to keep on doing stuff on short-term memory that sort of was a bit based on broadbent kind of things. He was an extraordinary man, Hebb. And he managed to get funding, and he would fund a lot of people. I discovered years later he hardly ever put his name on the stuff.
Huh.
You know, that he put his name on a few papers, but he would kind of try to write the general kind of stuff, the theory. About anything experimental, he just sort of said, "No, you write it, it's your..." So he was a huge influence by a lot of people, but his name didn't appear except as a funder.